is great, because that way I can make sure that none of you actually get lost at all. So I prepared this talk to be very, very simple, right? So I also hope that no one here gets bored about it, right? There was someone from the IQC that was about to come, and he said it was his birthday, but he wanted to come so badly to this talk that he doesn't matter. So I prepared for him a slide. In the end, he didn't come, right? But just for the record, right? I mean, I'm very happy that he didn't come. He's probably doing something more useful with his time in his birthday, right? So I don't know what's your background in what concerns quantum optics, but or maybe detectors in relativistic settings, because it's pretty similar, right? I'm going to talk about something called the Unruh-de-Witt detector model, right? So I don't know, may I ask how many of you know these kind of Hamiltonians from other settings? Probably, yeah, okay, most of you or every one of you, that's great. So just to give you a bit of intuition of what this is a simple, very simple model. In this case, as you can see, it's a discrete, okay, I'm gonna use that, discrete field model, right? It's a very simple model of interaction between a matter and radiation, right, and light. In this case, it's actually a Hamiltonian, that this Hamiltonian couples a two-level system, right? This is the sigma x operator in the interaction picture of a two-level system with a scalar field, right? This is a scalar field evaluated at the point where the detector is, right? Actually, it's a scalar field expanded in terms of its modes. So basically, what I did is the following, right? What we do to obtain that is the following. We have a cavity, right, of length L. And inside that cavity, we have a scalar field. So we have the wave equation inside a cavity. So we solve the wave equation, right? And that provides, for example, a set of stationary waves, a set of complete set of solutions to the wave equation inside that cavity, right? So the solution to the wave equation, those stationary waves, can be actually used to expand the field, the general solution to the equation. So after second quantizing the field and everything that you're very used to, what you end up obtaining is something like this, right? So as you can see, this kind of interaction, I'm going to use the blackboard for this, this kind of interaction is telling you that I have some coupling strength, something that is usually called the monopole moment of the two-level system, right? Which is this basically sigma x, right? And that's coupled to the field, to the quantum field, evaluated at the point where the detector is, where the two-level system is. So basically, I'm assuming here that I have a point-like system that couples to the field locally, exactly at the position where the two-level system is, right? So you can imagine an atom, for example, a two-level atom, right? The internal degrees of freedom of an atom, right? Seeing the field only locally, right? At the point where the atom is. So the oh, you missed your birthday cake. I prepared one for you, but you just missed it.
I'm sorry.
It's all right. So basically, I consider an atom, right? That locally, that sees the field only locally, right? So this, what this means is basically this is the field operator evaluated at a position x, but that position x is parameterized in terms of the proper time of the two-level system, right? So I have a two-level system that is moving, and that two-level system's position changes with time. This is this x of tau, right? This is the position where my two-level system is. And basically, that Hamiltonian is coupling that detector with the field evaluated at the position at which the detector is instantaneously, right? Actually, one has to be very careful when one does relativistic settings with detectors like that, right? Because, of course, you could describe the same experiment, the same setting, from different points of view, from different reference frames, right? So here we've chosen to write that Hamiltonian. That Hamiltonian generates time translations with respect to the proper time of the two-level system, okay? So I have an atom, right, that has a given proper time, for sure, because it's got some state of motion, and it's measuring, every atom is equipped with a clock, right? We all know that. This two-level system has a characteristic frequency here, which is the energy gap between the two levels of the system, let's say a ground state and an excited state, and that's a clock, right? That basically, you can use that to measure time. Well, so we have this tau over there, we call it to the proper time of this two-level system, right, seen by itself. And then, of course, we actually expanded the field. We can choose any kind of solutions to the field equation to expand the field. So in particular, we choose the solutions that we know better, which is, okay, in the lab frame, a cavity is addressed. The cavity won't move, right? So it's better for us to solve the wave equation in the frame in which the cavity is, because the cavity won't move, and that will be just stationary waves, right? But as you can see, the time here is the time for which those solutions actually are computed. So that doesn't have to necessarily correspond to the proper time of the detector. And one has to be really careful, right? Because this is in analytical mechanics, changing the time parameter with respect to Hamiltonian generates translation, it's a canonical transformation that in which you have to take into account some prefactoring there. Well, in here, just for simplicity, I just write it in this form in which the prefactor is actually 1 for the interaction Hamiltonian. But to give you a hint, it's not trivial to write those Hamiltonians in general when you have, you're describing systems that couple, and those systems have actually different state of motion, so different proper time, right? So one has to be careful with which time this Hamiltonian is generating translations, right? Okay, this said, to begin with, let's forget about any relativistic considerations, or at least not inertial relativity considerations, right? So we have, imagine that we have an inertial detector, right? So if we have an inertial detector, to make it even simpler, addressed, right? The parametrization of the world line of the detector, so the trajectory of the detector in spacetime, is as simple as that. So you see, the detector is sitting at a position x0 with respect to the frame of the cavity, right? So it doesn't move. And the proper time of the detector is actually the same time for which we actually obtain the solutions to the field equation. So basically, the cavity and the detector share the same proper time, okay? If we do that, we get something that is very well known in quantum optics, because that's very similar to something called the James Cummings Hamiltonian, right? Only that is multimode. Usually in the James Cummings Hamiltonian, you do 2 things. You do something called the rotating wave approximation and the single mode approximation, all right? And I'll get into that in a second. So let's just analyze what we have in here, right? Here we have what kind of terms we have in this Hamiltonian. So basically we have 2 kinds of terms, right? These terms that are usually called the rotating wave terms, right? And these other terms that are called the counter-rotating wave terms. So what do they do? Okay, so imagine that I consider like this, right? So I have, let's say, imagine that I forget about the infinite number of modes that I have here, and I just consider a single mode, just to get some intuition about what's going on here. If there were a single mode in there, something that is very incorrect in the context of relativity, by the way, but just to give you an insight on that, let's just forget for a second that we have an infinite number of modes there. So imagine that we have only 1 mode, right? And 1 mode for which actually omega j is equal to omega. So we not only have 1 mode, also we consider a mode which is resonant with the characteristic frequency of the detector. All right? So what kind of processes are allowed in this case due to those terms, right? Oh, by the way, interrupt me at any point if there's something that you don't understand or you want to tell me to not to tell you about because you already know anything, right? I'll be happy to answer questions. So we imagine that we have this case. So I have, for example, let's say a photon in the field, right, of frequency, let's say omega, because they coincide. And I have my atom in the ground state. Okay, well, the rotating wave terms, right, actually this term over here will actually give you something. If you have that, time evolution at first order perturbation theory, let's say, will give you via this term, right, will give you 0 photons in the field, or phonons, whatever you want to call them, and the atom in an excited state, right? And that kind of makes sense from the point of view of classical physics, right? Because what this is telling you is, okay, you had your cavity in an excited state, your atom in a ground state, basically the atom captured a photon and got excited. That's what these kind of processes are describing. But notice that we also have the counter-rotating wave contribution, right? Those guys actually allow for processes like this. Imagine I have the vacuum state, so no photons in the field, ground state of the detector, and via these terms, I can get 1 photon in the field and the atom in the excited state, okay? So those processes do exist in this Hamiltonian, so they are allowed by this Hamiltonian. It could happen, right? So one question that someone may ask, right, I guess it's a good question for a quantum optics course, is, okay, this kind of makes sense, because I have an energy, let's say, h bar omega here, and an energy which is in the field, right, and an energy h bar omega in here, which is now in the atom. Yeah, okay, makes sense. Here I have an energy zero, and then I end up with an energy 2h bar omega, right? So one question, if that happened, right? So one question that I can ask is, okay, is that violating energy conservation? So anyone here want to answer that? Anyone that doesn't know? Because I know that you know the answer for sure. Anyone that may have doubts about it? Well, the answer is no, it doesn't, right? So there are two ways to answer that question. First of all, well, in the inertial case, if this guy is equal to that guy, that Hamiltonian is just the interaction picture Hamiltonian of something, of a Hamiltonian in the Schrödinger picture doesn't have explicit time dependence, right? And we know for sure from quantum physics, right, from our first courses in quantum physics, that if a Hamiltonian is not time dependent, energy is preserved at all times, right? But that's the case. Energy conservation is not violated. So why do we have something that appears to allow this kind of transition that appear to violate energy conservation? Well, the reason is simple, right? Those guys are eigenstates of the free Hamiltonian for sure, right? So they have a well-defined energy when they're free, but they are not eigenstates of the interaction Hamiltonian, right? So they are not eigenstates of the whole Hamiltonian. So these guys actually don't have a very well-defined value of energy. So they actually have some average energy and then some uncertainty, right? So it's not true that we really have energy zero here and energy 2h bar omega here. We have some distributions of energy, right? So given that these guys are not eigenstates of the whole Hamiltonian, we can't really say that we're violating energy conservation. Sorry? I understood you were going to say something. So then someone from quantum optics working in a lab can tell us, well, but you know, I've been working on that all my life, and I've never seen anything like this. To be honest, I've never seen that I had the vacuum and the ground state and ended up with an excited state and photons. Really, I don't see those. Well, the reason for that is like, well, of course, because the experiments that you're doing are not fast enough. Why do I mean by that? Well, sorry. So you see that these guys have some weights in the Hamiltonian, right? Which, for example, the rotating wave terms have this kind of weight here. These guys have some weight as well, which is like that, right? So if we write it for the inertial case, we see that the rotating wave terms are weighted in that case, right? By omega minus omega j t, but it happens that this guy is actually zero in resonance, right? So if omega is equal to omega j, right, this wave is basically one, all right? Whereas the counter-rotating wave terms are weighted by this, right? So that's basically two omega. And this guy is a highly oscillatory function. Well, depending on omega, of course, but it's a highly oscillatory function. So keep in your mind that when we compute in time evolution through the Hamiltonian, we have to integrate over time these kind of waves, right? That integration over time gives us basically, if we integrate in over times that are longer than 1 over omega, of the order of 1 over omega, or longer than that, we're basically promediating the value of that function. And that actually promediates to 0, averages to 0. So the contribution, the stationary phase for these guys, actually, if you solve it, that gives you that the only contribution that matters is this one. So for times long enough, there's no contribution that is non-negligible from the counter-rotating wave terms. Actually, if for infinite times, that contribution is zero, identically zero, right? But what happened if we were doing fast quantum optics? People can do it right now. They do it in superconducting circuits. They do it in fast quantum optics. What happens if we're actually measuring something, some time evolution in time scales that are smaller than that? Well, in those cases, you would expect to observe that. It could happen to you, right? It's not surprising. You switch on an interaction, right? And then, of course, what you had, which was the ground state of the free Hamiltonian, is no longer the ground state of the whole Hamiltonian, right? So, of course, if you measure in that basis, it's likely that you may obtain something like that. So it's not so surprising, right? But that kind of gives you an idea. So people usually in quantum optics do something called the rotating wave approximation and also the single mode approximation. The single mode approximation is basically neglecting all the modes except for the resonant ones. Kind of makes sense, right? Because as you can see, this guy is actually weighted with a 1, but if we consider the second harmonic of the cavity, right, that would be omega minus twice omega, right, t, and that's, well, that's actually 1 omega here, right? And that's also highly oscillatory. So that what they say, this kind of approximation is basically, let's only consider a single mode of the field and also the rotating wave terms. Both are equivalent approximations. So one thing that you can't do is doing one and not the other. There are papers around that, for example, working quantum optics effects that appear beyond the, what they call beyond the rotating wave approximation, that they still keep it single mode. Well, no, both approximations are actually the same, right? We're saying that we consider time evolution longer, way longer than that, such that any effects coming from here or from here are neglected. So rotating wave approximation and single mode approximation are very closely related to each other, right? Other thing that I won't talk about here is what happens if you want to consider causality of the model. The model, if you do the rotating wave approximation or the single mode approximation, becomes non-causal. You can actually relativistic do faster than light signaling with that. So to be actually properly, to properly consider relativistic settings, you need to keep that. You have an infinite number of modes and you need to keep those guys as well. All right? So, I don't know what happened. Okay, cool. So, yeah, so this is very good and okay if we consider inertial detectors, right? So what happens if the trajectory of those detectors is actually non-inertial? Well, okay, things change a little bit. So the parametrization of the world line of the detector, of the atom, the two-level system, I will use the three words indistinctively, right? So if you hear me saying the atom, or the detector, or the qubit, or the two-level system, I mean the same thing. Okay, so the trajectory that in the past was like, in the previous slide, it was like, okay, stationary, like sitting on a position in a cavity, and having the same time as the time that you use to construct your basis of solutions to the wave equation, that's no longer as simple, right? If you're accelerating, your trajectory in space-time is like that, right? I can draw it, maybe, if I know how to, yeah. So if you consider the trajectory, well, whereas, for example, I mean, if you're sitting here, right, if your cavity is here, an observer sitting here would move like that through space, which is what we considered before. But if you're accelerating, your trajectory is actually hyperbolic, right? So you move like that. Not quite, right? Doesn't hit the light cone, for sure. So it gets as close as possible to the light cone of this guy, but hyperbolically, whatever, you understand what I mean, right? So you start accelerating and your speed, at the beginning, you start with constant speed, but your speed is increasing, 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 right, until you get really close to the speed of light, but never reaching it, right? The parametrization of the trajectory, the world line of a detector, which is moving with a constant proper acceleration A, is this one, okay? That's usually similar to the Rindler change of coordinates, right, because the Rindler coordinates are the proper coordinates for an accelerated observer, right?
Sorry.
Yep.
The trajectory is completely classical, right? It's relativistic, but classical.
That is correct. No quantum considerations with respect to the motion of the atom, right? Yeah. We are in energies way below the energies that would need that kind of treatment, yeah. So, all right. So, in this case, yes, this is just to illustrate what happens with the rotating wave approximation for long times. Well, the point here is that this term, that is the rotating wave term, still continues being highly oscillatory. So one would think, okay, I could neglect that one. In principle, it's even more oscillatory than before. But the rotating wave term also becomes highly oscillatory as well. And in fact, you can't neglect the rotating wave terms, sorry, the counter-rotating wave terms in front of the rotating wave terms, because both contribute almost with the same order, right? So the contributions coming from both terms are non-negligible, so you can't do the single mode, the rotating wave approximation. And for sure, you can't do either the single mode approximation. The detector sees actually the field being red shifted and blue shifted, so it doesn't stay resonant with the same mode all the time, right? So, okay, so here you can't do the counter-rotating wave approximation even for long times, right? All right, what does that mean? Well, we just discussed that the counter-rotating terms allow for vacuum excitations. What do I mean by that? I mean that I have the vacuum state in the cavity, the ground state of my atom, I let them interact, and they get excited, right? So I get photons, or phonons in this case, and excitations of the atom, okay? Well, that's not so surprising if you read Birrell and Davis, right? Because basically, this is telling you, well, this is the kind of integrals that you have, of course, but this is what is behind the Unruh effect as seen from a detector, right? So there are several ways to approach the Unruh effect. One is based on Bogoliubov transformation and transformation changes of bases. But another one which is cleaner is the following. Actually, Unruh likes it better, I think, is the following. Look, I can describe the whole physics of the process from an inertial point of view. So I'm inertial here, and I can describe in my lab an accelerated detector. And I see the vacuum, right? And I see the detector in the ground state. So does still the detector see a thermal state? It's got some excitation that actually makes it look thermal. And yes, the answer is yes. And the reason for that, well, that there are some non-perturbative results about that that we actually finished recently, but I'm not putting them here. Not only in perturbation theory, but non-perturbatively, you can prove it. The accelerated detector proving the vacuum detects field quanta. This is this kind of thing, right? We have a detector in the ground state probing the vacuum, and it sees field quanta, get excited, right? With some excitation rate. And that excitation rate happens to be Planckian with a temperature which is proportional to the acceleration. Well, that's the Unruh effect. And that's the reason why you have it is because of this time dependence or this dependence of the time in which you parameterize the field solutions and the proper time of the detector. Okay? So, all right, so that's the Unruh effect for sure. The Unruh effect, the problem is that it's very small, right? You need acceleration of the order of 10 to the 16 g to detect it, right? That's too bad. This is in the best case scenario, right? And in the worst case scenario, you need like above 26 g or something like that. So that's actually very much, right? Okay, so now let me reflect on the following. So the standard view about all these effects of acceleration or general relativistic effects in our ability to do quantum information has been quite pessimistic in the past, right? Due to the Unruh effect, for example, the Unruh effect basically introduces noise in systems, like two-level systems, right? So in principle, one would think that we can't really get anything good becoming general relativistic. To begin with, because the accelerations required and gravitational fields required are huge, and we can't do this kind of experiment. But to continue, is okay, why would we want to do it if it provides nothing good, right? Well, I mean, that's not maybe 100% honest by me, but I will try to sell you that something similar happened to quantum effects in the past, right? Of course, I'm not being honest, but maybe if I had said something like that about quantum effects in the 1940s or something like that, people would have thought the same, right? So that's why I'm saying it right now. So keeping the distances, for sure, in the past, when quantum effects started to appear in quantum classical information processing, people actually saw them as a problem, because quantum effects actually are sources of noise, right, for this kind of process of information, right? So we try to process classical information using the states of some semiconductor array. And of course, we are miniaturizing the microchip so much that the chance that there's some quantum tunneling between the conductors is non-negligible, and that's a source of noise that people actually study. So IBM, when they started, and then Intel and all the others after that, actually they hired physicists to try to account for those effects as sources of noise, and then engineers actually built ways to counter those effects, right? So basically to compensate for the quantum effects that they have, right? So the philosophy that, I'm not the only one who has that philosophy. For example, there's a group in Nottingham working in accelerated cavities before I did that, right? These accelerated atoms, and they also pursue these kind of ideas, right? This philosophy, which is, well, you know, when we started getting clever about quantum physics, we found out that we can do very cool stuff if we actually take advantage of quantum effects instead of seeing it as a problem, right? So maybe it is possible that general relativistic effects can be used to get some computational advantage over non-relativistic settings. Not today, right? I'm not saying I'm going to try to convince you that I'm going to give you a relativistic quantum computer. No way that's going to happen, right? No way that's going to happen. I'm the first one saying that. But I will give you a proof of principle that shows that it is possible to do quantum computing based on relativistic effects. Okay, so this just was kind of an advertisement, right? This is more the real stuff. So first, a glimpse of what happens if you consider the cavity in the vacuum, as I said. So you consider a cavity in the vacuum, and then you get a detector, and you move it inside the cavity with some huge acceleration, right? Okay, there are good news and bad news, right? Good news is that, yes, we proved that it is possible to move in the Bloch sphere by just changing acceleration. So we can actually have some degree of control in the trajectory of the qubit on the Bloch sphere, right, by controlling the relativistic acceleration. By relativistic acceleration, I mean high enough such that for the times of evolution that we're considering, you get relativistic speeds, right? Because there's no such thing as a relativistic acceleration, right? There's relativistic speeds. But when I say relativistic acceleration, I mean such that you get relativistic speeds, right? So, yeah, the bad news is what it was known, I guess, right? Which is, yeah, look, the transformation between the block vector, so you just consider the subsystem of that is consists of the detector, right? You get that the transformation of the block vector is actually an affine transformation, and that introduced mixedness in our setting, right? So our detector gets mixed, right? This is the noise effect, right? And it gets mixed at the same order in the coupling strength, right, as it gets rotated, right? So if we get a rotation in the block sphere of order lambda, we get mixedness of order lambda. That's too bad. That's very bad. If you want to sell that you can do quantum, some sort of quantum process, quantum information processing, because that's telling you that the noise actually kills anything that you want to do. That's really bad, right? But no one says that we have to use the vacuum for that, right? Actually, using the vacuum would be a very bad idea. To begin with, it's very difficult to prepare a cavity in the vacuum state, right? Cavities are usually in thermal states, and to overcome that, what we do is focus in very strong lasers, for example, and prepare them in high energy, I don't know, coherent states, for example, right? So the philosophy is the following. Maybe by preparing some other state in the cavity, we can overcome that noise and make it negligible, right? Which is pretty likely what's going to happen. Oh, okay. Yep. So what if instead of the vacuum, we prepare a coherent state in the cavity? So for one of the modes of the cavity, I shine a laser, right? And I prepare something that looks like a coherent state in the cavity, right? Well, you can prove that in those cases, simplifying the thing very much, the transformation of the density matrix, the partial density matrix of the detector, is like that. You can write it like that, first order in perturbation theory. Okay, well, that may look familiar, right? That transformation is actually unitary, and it's a differential rotation, an infinitesimal rotation in the Bloch sphere. So, you see, if you prepare a coherent state instead of preparing the vacuum, which is also a coherent state, I know, but it's a pretty specific one. If you prepare a coherent state different from the vacuum, right, you get that the first order contribution in perturbation theory, which is zero for the vacuum, as you can see here, right, this is the alpha of the coherent state. So for if alpha is zero, that's zero, and the whole contribution at first order is zero, and the first order contribution is order two, right? But if you prepare a coherent state, you do have a first order contribution. And it happens that at first order contribution, we get an infinitesimal rotation in the Bloch sphere around the axis defined by this and of magnitude that. So basically you have a magnitude that is related to the intensity of the coherent state that you prepared and the coupling strength, okay? So the message here, yep.
So is the detector moving in this?
Sorry?
In this example, is the detector moving or?
The detector is moving, yeah.
And where does that enter? Which one, which?
The acceleration is inside here, these eyes. Those are the eyes that I showed before, right?
Okay.
Can go back a little bit. Yep. These eyes depend on the trajectory of the detector, which depends, of course, on the acceleration of the detector.
Thank you.
So now the question is, how good are those rotations, right? So we can, someone can say, okay, you can rotate, all right. And well, okay, I trust you. You're introducing no mixedness at leading order, all right? Does that mean that I can do quantum information processing? Of course not, because there's some ingredient that I'm missing here, which is control, right? I need to be able to control what I want to do in order to call these guys gates, right? These rotations gates. All right. Well, so this coefficient A, right, is of course a function of two things, two parameters. The time of interaction, which is basically related to the length of the cavity, in the case of constant acceleration, and the acceleration itself, okay? So basically my claim is that controlling the atom's acceleration and the interaction time, which are independent parameters, we can control both the axis with respect which rotation is performed and the magnitude of the rotation, right? So I don't need even to control alpha. Right? I could actually control the magnitude of the rotation by controlling alpha and the axis controlling alpha, but I don't need that. It's enough to say, to control two parameters that are subjected to relativity if you want, right? Acceleration and time. And this is what you obtain. So basically, maybe you think I'm cheating you writing here natural units. I will get to that. I'll tell you what that means, okay? But basically what we can have is depending, if we vary either the acceleration or the time of interaction, we can actually have the rotation axis to vary. We can actually have two rotation axes that are as far apart as 90 degrees almost, right? And then the amount of rotation can be controlled also through the acceleration or through the time of evolution, right? So you can prove that you can perform two independent rotations, right? If you can do two independent rotations, you can control your system such that you do two independent rotations. Oh yeah, well, it's impossible to do it inertially. I will get to that later if I have time, right? But yeah, there's no inertial setting in which you're just controlling the time. You can actually do something like that. But that's, maybe I don't have time for that. Okay, so if you can do two independent rotations, you can actually do anything in the block sphere, right? Because the only thing that you need is an array of rotations. You can concatenate several rotations and reach any point of the block sphere that you want, almost any point, right? I mean, I'm being lousy with my language here, but if you have questions to ask, and I think that you understand what I mean, right? So basically, I can just prepare an array of cavities of different length that controls the time that they spend inside the cavities, and then some setting that accelerates the atom in every single cavity that actually is different for every single cavity. So that would be my gate, right? My gate is something like that. So I get an atom, I get it at the beginning of the gate, and then something here accelerates the atom with different accelerations, and in the end, I have the atom out, and the internal state of the atom, right, has been rotated as much as I want, depending on the array that I prepared in here, right? So yeah, actually, you don't need to get ultra-relativistic. One may think, okay, if you do something like that, and for a long time, you will end up with your atom having the speed of light and completely destroyed. Well, not really, because all those effects are actually independent of the sign of acceleration, right? These effects of rotations are even on the acceleration. So if we accelerate with different sign, we get the same effects. So we can actually accelerate here, decelerate here, and so on and so forth. And the atom can exit the array of cavities with the same speed as it got in, right? OK. So anytime I touch it. All right, so yeah, natural units. That's pretty fun. So if you say, I can do that, then people will say at the moment, oh, cool, so what is the acceleration that I need for that? And that's where the problem starts, right? Again, I'm not claiming that I can do a quantum computer based on acceleration, right? But if the natural unit of acceleration in here, it's given by that magnitude. Everything is related to the clock, the natural clock in the system, which is the atom, right? So if you consider atoms with a gap of gigahertz, right, you get that you need one natural unit of acceleration is 10 to the 16 g. If your gap, the gap of your atom is of the order of Earths, right, you get 10 to the 70. There's, of course, a compromise because you can't accelerate an atom as much as you want. You need to have some huge gap such that basically the atom resists that acceleration intact, right? That's difficult to begin with. But the kind of, well, these accelerations, there's a place in the world where you can reach those accelerations. There are many places in the world, to be honest, many, many. Every group that has an ultra-strong laser of femtosecond or nanosecond laser can do that to electrons, which is a different story that we may comment, right? As you may know very well. But can we do that to something else? Well, you know, these accelerations can be reached, for example, in the LHC. They do several orders of magnitudes above those accelerations. Main problem with that, well, I always say that if the LHC doesn't find any new physics, I can always try to convince them to convert it into the most expensive and by far the less efficient quantum computer ever, which is actually is cool. I mean, it's the kind of records that you actually presume of, right, I guess. Not sure, but maybe, right? The most expensive, for sure, right? You can always say that. All right, so those accelerations are difficult to reach, but not impossible. Not impossible meaning that there are papers, I don't know if I include it here, there are papers that claim that they can do that to atoms without destroying them. No, I don't have it here. That's too bad, I should have had it actually here. But there are papers, theoretical papers, of course. If you go to an atomic physicist, they will probably cry. I don't know. But in principle, in theory, the state of the art already allows for these kinds of accelerations. Actually, people do things that are even more difficult to conceive. For example, they do interferometry with electrons that are subjected to 10 to the 20 something g by moving the electron a little bit off a molecule where they are and then putting it back to the molecule again. And they are able to do interferometry with that. So they can measure phases on those settings, which is pretty amazing. They can actually accelerate atoms a lot. Problem is that those atoms are ionized and then, of course, transform into plasma. So, but you better choose your two-level system to be some internal electron that is not excited or something like that. And then you have to be very careful with all the other relativistic effects that you may have in those settings. So the message is, no, I'm not telling you, I mean, I remember someone asking me, oh, what are the advantages of doing this instead of any other means of quantum computer? And the answer is, of course, none at all, right? Not at this point, anyway. But what I'm claiming here, well, what we'll say in the end, is that in principle, you can do it. So you can be clever about those effects and actually do any unitary operation that you want for a single qubit. Ow. All right. So how about universal quantum computing, right? So to do universal quantum computing, you need at least to be able to implement a two-qubit gate, right? And have some control on it. I could try to convince you that it is possible to do that. The reason being, it is well known that two atoms that are interacting with the same field, right? If it's in a cavity, it's even better. They actually get entangled a lot. Not surprising, right? The whole system kind of heats up the cavity, so the cavity is in a mixed state. That means that some entanglement is being generated within the atoms and the field, and the two atoms are interacting with the field. Well, it's not surprising. What may be more surprising is that that happens even when the atoms are space-like separated, which is cool. So you can have two atoms space-like separated interacting with the quantum field, and given that the quantum field is non-local, so the quantum field in here and here is actually the noise, the quantum noise here and here is actually correlated. Two atoms interacting with the field here, we'll see just noise, but that noise here and here is correlated, and these two guys get entangled, even if they don't get to exchange any photons. That was discovered in 2005. Well, it was discovered before that. It was well known that the space-like separated regions of a quantum field are actually, you can violate Bell inequalities by measuring some observables in that. When you put atoms into play, that was done in 2005 by Resnick, Resker, and Seelmann. And from that moment on, many things appear about that. So now it is possible to do an experiment in the lab. We're borderline to being able to do an experiment of vacuum entanglement extraction in space-like regimes, right, with superconducting circuits and all. But what I'm saying is that, well, if you don't wait for space-like separation, just wait a little bit more, then you can get a pretty decent amount of entanglement, right? So by letting two atoms interact at the same time with the same field, with the same cavity, you can get them entangled. And through controlling the motion, you can also control that amount of entanglement. Right? So we haven't done the math yet, but we know it's possible, right? So it is possible to prove that you can actually do two-qubit gates, and therefore, two-qubit gates plus, yeah.
So, but, I mean, if you're only interacting with the atoms, then the gate that you get between them might not be a unitary gate, right? Because
that is correct. But depending on what state of the field you prepare, you may have something very close to a unitary. Like, for example, for a single atom, you got, at first order of perturbation theory, you got a rotation, something that is unitary. So,
right.
Yeah, it's a bit more tricky because you can say, well, if you use a coherent state, that's a very clever one. If you use a coherent state, then you probably won't generate much entanglement, right? Because coherent states are eigenstates of the field operator, right? So in principle, you probably won't mix the system very much and therefore you won't generate much entanglement. And I agree with that. But you can prepare other states, like squeeze states, for example. Those guys will generate entanglement and will produce something non-negligible at first order that is closer to a unitary than in the case of the vacuum. So yeah, that's why we haven't done the math, right? It's not trivial at all.
Well, yeah, but I mean, in principle, there could be just a complete trade-off between unitarity and entanglement, right?
Could be. Yeah, I agree with that. There could be a trade-off on that. That is right. That's actually a good point. But my guess is that with squeeze states in particular, you can actually control it. I mean, make it optimal anyway. So whatever you get, I'm not sure exactly what you will get a first order, and you will get something very close to a unitary, but the amount of entanglement that you can extract probably can be maximized, but as you say, it might be not possible with these kind of settings. Maybe you need to add something else, right? That's kind of the most innocent way to do it. Like, let's make them interact at the same time with the same field that we know produces entanglement, right? Okay, good point. All right. So what are the conclusions here? Well, what we're doing here is not so much different from NMR, right? You know, when people do quantum computing based on NMR, what they do is the following. They have a time-dependent Hamiltonian, and they're controlling the time dependence on the Hamiltonian of the Hamiltonian by means of an external parameter, which is an external field in the case of NMR, right? A magnetic field that is time-dependent. Here, we are controlling the time dependence of the Hamiltonian by the effects of time dilation and space contraction that come from the relativistic trajectory of the atom. So basically, by controlling time dilation effects and space contraction effects, we introduce the time dependence in the Hamiltonian. And that time dependence can be controlled, and therefore you can control what you're doing with your atoms by controlling the trajectory of the detector, right? So, yeah, something interesting here is that this might not be the best idea to do a quantum computer. Well, let's wait until we can produce micro black holes, right? If it gets to that, that would be a great quantum computer that you can actually have everywhere. But for now, I have to say that it's very unlikely that we can do a general relativistic quantum computer, right? Although it's possible, that's what I'm trying to defend here. But this is quite useful in the opposite way, right? So what about the Unruh effect? Detecting the Unruh effect is something interesting. No one has done it yet. At least no one that has been acknowledged has been actually able to do it. So yeah, so you see, usually to detect the Unruh effect, what we do is the following. We have a detector, any kind of detector that you want, and you want to accelerate it. That detector will get excited. There's some chance that the detector gets excited, which is very tiny, right? Because of the Unruh temperature being very small. So detecting amplitudes, probability amplitudes is difficult, right? Transition amplitudes, transition probabilities are difficult to detect. However, small movement in the Bloch sphere is way easier to produce than a non-negligible probability of excitation, right? In the sense that if you can measure the state of an atom very well, the internal state of an atom very well, you might get some advantage in order to determine if that effect happened. So what I told you is necessary and sufficient condition for the Unruh effect to happen. It's not the Unruh effect, for sure, but if the Unruh effect weren't true, so if the response of a detector which is accelerated to the vacuum state of the field weren't thermal, that wouldn't happen, right? And if it wasn't possible to get universal one-qubit gates out of relativistic motion like that, accelerated motion, the Unruh effect wouldn't exist. That has to do with what I mentioned, that this is impossible to do inertially. So this could be an indirect proof of the Unruh effect. So imagine that I ask an experimentalist the following. Look, tell me how good you are in order to see small changes in the Bloch sphere of an internal state of an atom, and I will tell you how much acceleration you need to apply and for how long to get that. And if you detect that, and you can determine that that was it, and it's different from what you would get in the case of the inertial motion, then you have detected the Unruh effect. Indirectly, I agree, but this is an indirect proof of the Unruh effect, right? So yeah, the resolution of the experiment will give you the acceleration that you would need in order to detect that, right? And that's more like the hope of feasibility that we have with these settings. All right, yeah, for sure, that's what I told you. Yeah, so there's the message here is like well, quantum effects in the past were considered pernicious for processing of information, right? Now we know that if we're clever, we can actually take advantage of it. Well, general relativistic effects can be beneficial too to process quantum information. And this is only for quantum information processing, right? How about quantum communication? We're working on many things related to quantum channels and protocols of quantum communication in relativistic settings. Relativistic settings do impose restrictions to security of protocols and stuff like that. So it is interesting to try to be clever, to use relativistic effects in order to gain some advantage over non-relativistic settings. Again, I agree, I'm trying to be also conservative enough about this. I'm not saying that we're gonna find a great idea and then everyone will try to, we're gonna have the RIQC or something like that in the future. I'm not saying that, right? What I'm saying is that, look, if we're clever using quantum mechanics, we can do fun stuff. If we're clever using relativity, maybe we can also do fun stuff, right? And if I had said something like that in the 50s, like quantum physics can actually be used to process information, I know that many people wouldn't have believed me, probably myself included, right? But like today, right, with this. So maybe in the future, who knows? Maybe in the future we find a really efficient way to generate micro black holes, right? There are several theories of quantum gravity that already predict this kind of things, right? So maybe that if we're able to do something like that, then all those things are no longer outside of our reach, right? We could be able to do that. So, okay, last thing I want to tell you. Yeah, this is a bit of, I don't know if I'm allowed, but it's a bit of advertising, right? Just very quick. I'm starting giving a series of four lectures on that. It's called Introduction to Relativistic Quantum Info. And this is within the courses that the IQC is offering that they call Advanced Topics in Quantum Info. Those are the coordinates of the place. So if you want to pop by, I think that everyone can go as long as there's people that are enrolled in that. And they are getting marks and everything. But if there's enough room, that I think there will be, everyone that arrives there is allowed to stay. So just if you want to provide, you're interested of knowing what is this business of, so where is that business of relativistic quantum information going? I will try to give you a glimpse of it, right, within my possibilities, right? Okay, that's also, that's everything. Thank you very much for your patience here.
Any questions?
Yep.
So you mentioned micro black holes at the end. Have you thought about how big a black hole you'd actually need in order to do this?
Not very big. If you can produce something of the order of centimeters, that would do.
Okay, but a black hole of order of centimeters is a huge mass.
I know, but that's, you know, in these cases, the higher the mass, the less quantum they are. So the smaller, the better. If you can produce a micro black hole of, I don't know, picometers, that's even better.
Well, but then the atom, I mean, the tidal forces, when you get close to get a high enough acceleration, you have to be very close to it, the tidal force will be very fast.
For sure. Then the same as here, right? The limit that you, for acceleration, something similar happened. So the limit are very, very similar. So basically, let me do a fast calculation. So something like, I guess to be within the same limits that I told you about, something within the regime of millimeters to microns would do in terms of black holes.
Okay.
Which is a lot of energy, I agree.
Yeah.
But if you have several micro black holes, you can also do something like that. Like instead of one, you have several of them.
Yeah, okay, to make some sort of approximately constant.
You will, in the end, if you produce those micro black holes, probably you won't be able to produce just one. You will have actually a superposition of many. So it's not trivial. What I'm saying is, just saying that I can produce, if I were able to produce micro black holes, I wouldn't be worried about this. Yeah, like, I would be more
about
worried.
Stuff you'd be doing.
Yeah, well, winning the Nobel Prize probably, right? If I got micro black holes. But the thing is that the kind of gravity that you need for that is, of course, comparable to the kind of acceleration that you need. Either being really close to the horizon of a huge black hole, or not so close to the horizon, but a smaller black hole. But of course, yes, I have to do this exercise of confessing that this is far away from being a useful way to do quantum information processing. Yeah. Just a proof of principle.
Yeah. Actually, I mean, it's further away from the smaller black hole is because a larger fraction of the black hole size, right?
Yes. That is right. But then what I mean, there are two effects competing here. You want huge accelerations, but not huge enough to destroy your atom.
Right.
Right, so yeah.
Other questions?
So in your gate construction, you have different accelerations in different parts. Is there anything funny happening when you change the acceleration? Because I understand the Unruh effect only for eternal acceleration.
Because that's the classical derivation of the Unruh effect, yeah.
So does something funny happen?
There are finite time effects, right? But that also will happen in a regular Unruh effect. So basically, the eternal acceleration derivation has been criticized a lot. Even by Unruh himself, I think, doesn't like it. And the reason is, there are several reasons. First of all, you need infinite energy for that. And that's unphysical. But there's a better reason to reject that is within relativity itself, which is the following. So, do we have erasers here?
Those big white blocks.
Oh, cool. Yeah, didn't look like that. Right, so for the standard derivation of the Unruh effect, you need to consider trajectory like that, right? Just like eternal acceleration, right? So then you can ask the following. I have a detector here that sees the Unruh effect. All right, so if it were true that I need infinite acceleration in order to see the thermal state, that would mean that if this guy here is seeing a thermal state, this guy will know automatically not only that he's been accelerating forever in the past, which is fine. It's not fine. You need infinite energy for that. But I guess it's fine, more or less, so within some approximation. But he also needs to know what he's going to be doing in the future. So if I measure some thermal state out of something that I know is the vacuum, I will know for sure what I'm going to do in the future, right? And that's not a nice idea. Because this guy, you can actually do a finite time experiment and spoil it up completely, right? So the derivation using eternal acceleration is kind of flawed, right? And then that's why they introduce the rate of a detector, right? When it was Unruh himself and DeWitt that introduced the Unruh-DeWitt model for that, in which they say, oh, look, we consider a detector which is accelerated. Let's see the rate of transition of this guy. And then if you go, we actually have a paper in PRD recently. Well, if you look in the archive, my last name will appear, that in which we actually study the Unruh effect in cavitates for finite times. And we see that we get the Unruh effect, so we got a response that is thermal and proportional to the acceleration, right? But you have to be very careful with the boundary effects, for sure. There are boundary effects. You don't have something as nice as thermal, but very close to thermality, though. So yeah, there are effects, but those effects are also part of the Unruh effect in that matter, right? What I mean is, no one expects to see something that requires a thermal acceleration, ever, in the lab, because that would imply things that are not very well founded. Like to know that just because I'm detecting this, I know that I'm going to be accelerating forever, right? So yeah, the answer is yes, but that's also part of the Unruh effect, yes. And of course, taking into account here, right? It's taken into account because we always consider finite time interactions. Just also a point that may be interesting to answer that question is that when you change cavities, your atoms are effectively decoupled from the field. Because the field inside a cavity, right, the modes are sine functions that have nodes on the walls of the cavities, right? So all the modes are basically, you had some integral of some temporal part times a sine function of kx, x of tau, of course. That function would be zero on the walls. So that means that the transition from one cavity to the other is smooth, and actually the field, the interaction is switched off at the moment where it changes. So nothing relevant will happen here if the cavity is ideal.
For one more question. No, then let's thank Eduardo again.
Thank you.